For all of our summer crops, the pigweeds are the number one weed problems. So we have two of these, you know, dioecious pigweed species. So they have male and female plants, and they have lots of cross pollination and lots of opportunities for sharing genetic information and potentially developing herbicide resistance. So west of an area that we call the Flint Hills, which is basically the eastern three quarters of the state, or the, I'm sorry, the western three quarters of the state of Kansas, the number one weed problem is Palmer amaranth.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, Assistant Professor in Integrative Precision Agriculture at the University of Georgia. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Sarah Lancaster. She's an Assistant Professor and Extension Weed Management Specialist at Kansas State University. Sarah, welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. It's great to have you here with us today. And to get us started, I wanted to ask you if you can share with us a little bit about your story, your history, and how you got to where you are today.
Thanks for inviting me onto the podcast, Leo. I think we'll have a great conversation today. So how did I get to K-State? I took a little bit of a circuitous route compared to some folks. I am a Missouri farm girl. At heart. So I have an undergraduate degree from the University of Missouri in Columbia. And then I have a master's degree from North Carolina State University and a PhD from Texas A&M University. So I kind of hopped around a little bit. And then my first professional experience after graduate school was actually teaching undergraduate agronomy at Oklahoma State University. So I've gotten to see a lot of different systems and meet a lot of different people and have learned and enjoyed every step of the way. But it is fun being here at K-State and kind of back to what I really enjoy doing, which is weed management for farmers. So
nice. That's super cool. Very like lots of experiences in different states, different cropping systems. So very exciting.
So, yep, it was fun.
And can you tell me a little bit about what are some of the projects that you are working with currently?
Like a lot of folks in my role, we do have a herbicide evaluation program. That's kind of the, I guess, kind of the bread and butter for most folks in my type of role. So we evaluate herbicides with industry partners in corn, soybeans, grain sorghum. We've dabbled in some other things as well. So wheat. But those are the main crops where we have herbicide evaluation programs. Being here in eastern Kansas, I'm really kind of in this corn and soybean area. So it's very Midwestern here. My colleagues further to the west, they do more work in grain sorghum and wheat. So that's kind of one thing that takes a good chunk of our time. But other things that we have going that are a little more maybe novel would be a lot of programs just looking at integrated weed management types of projects. So one project we have, well, and let me back up. So a lot of these integrated weed management projects are funded by farmer checkoff dollars. So a lot of them, not a lot of them, all of them are very much applied and looking at practical solutions for giving farmers tools that can complement our herbicide programs and crops. So some things that my team has been working on, this week we just worked on a cover crop trial. So that trial is actually, it's a big collaborative effort led by Rodrigo Worley at the University of Wisconsin, another Brazilian. So looking at how termination timing and residual herbicides all interact to affect weed management and soybean yield. Another project that we were talking about with my team just a few minutes ago is an intercropping study. That study is actually led by the University of Arkansas. So we have wheat planted and we're putting soybeans into the wheat, trying to see if we can suppress weeds that way and still get a wheat crop out of the the deal. So looking at the economics and the weed management there. Other things that my team has going, I've got a graduate student who's doing some on-farm work looking at targeted herbicide application technologies. So kind of looking at the differences between single boom systems and the two boom, two tank types of systems, and looking at weed control and crop response and things of that nature. So those are some of the kind of big things we have going on right now. We also, in addition to the herbicide evaluation programs, have kind of the standard herbicide resistance screening process and projects ongoing, where we're just trying to help farmers figure out, are your weeds resistant to a certain herbicide, or was it just an application mishap, things of that nature. So lots of fun stuff, never a dull day in weed science.
So one thing I wanted to ask if you could develop a little bit more is, I'm not sure if, you know, maybe some parts of our audience are not familiar with the checkoff system or even what that means. So could you perhaps just talk a little bit about that, so we're all on the same page about that?
Yeah, that's a great follow-up, Leo. So for many of our commodities, what happens when farmers go to the elevator and they sell their crop is a certain portion of every bushel that they sell is levied. And it's like, you know, maybe a penny or 1/10 of a penny, something like that. And that money then is allocated to organizations that are farmer led. And those folks get to decide how that money is spent. Now, the intent is for things that help production, things that help marketing and use to drive continued strong prices, things of that nature. So, you know, every commodity takes a different approach. The soybean group has been super invested in pest management and agronomics, not only for my program, but, you know, I mentioned other programs as well. And so it's just been a very, very good relationship, that we have with our soybean producers who, you know, when we think about weed management in the U.S., at least in kind of the Corn Belt and East, the driver weeds, the number one weed problems are the dioecious pigweeds. So Palmer amaranth and water hemp. And being broadleaf weeds in a broadleaf crop like soybeans, right, we've kind of run through a lot of our herbicide options and have limited their effectiveness due to resistance. And so weed management in soybeans is a big challenge.
Perfect. Well, thanks for clarifying that. And I guess just a quick connection here. So Rodrigo was actually a guest on the podcast recently. His episode is out. So if you're listening to this and you want to follow up on that conversation, make sure to check that episode. It was another great one, just like I'm sure this is going to be here with Dr. Lancaster. All right, Sarah. So talking more about weeds in Kansas. So you gave us a little comment here about some of the most problematic ones, but I just want to expand a little bit more on that. So for Kansas cropping systems, what are the most troublesome weeds, and what are some of the options that you're using to control them?
So for all of our summer crops, the pigweeds are the number one weed problem. So we have two of these, you know, dioecious pigweed species. So they have male and female plants, and they have lots of cross-pollination and lots of opportunities for sharing genetic information and potentially developing herbicide resistance. So west of an area that we call the Flint Hills, which is basically the eastern three quarters of the state, the western three quarters of the state of Kansas, the number one weed problem is Palmer amaranth, especially in our summer crops. And then east of the Flint Hills, so kind of the sliver between Manhattan and Kansas City, we still have water hemp. So water hemp would be what most of our friends, Rodrigo's group, the folks in the eastern Corn Belt. So that's number one. We fight that one also in our wheat-based systems. So in western Kansas, we have still grow a fair amount of wheat. Those acres have been decreasing, but it's still a very important crop in those rotations. And so even though the Palmer amaranth is not necessarily competitive with wheat from a yield perspective, what can happen is if we have a poor wheat crop, so let's say we have a drier year and we don't have a good canopy in wheat, we will start to see Palmer amaranth come through that wheat canopy and cause lots of problems for harvest. And then if you get your wheat out, you have to keep that wheat stubble weed free until you plant your next crop. And so in a lot of cases, that next crop is going to be planted the following May. So you've got to keep that field clean from the end of June through early May of the next year. And so again, Palmer amaranth is the number one. It can emerge in the state anywhere from April to October. So it's always an issue. Other weeds that get lots of attention in the state of Kansas would be kochia. So that's our kind of classic tumbleweed is kochia. So it has a lot of problems with herbicide resistance and a lot of, again, information exchange in terms of genetics, just largely because of how those weed seeds are dispersed across the environment as the weeds literally tumble through the fields. In wheat systems, we talk a lot about the mustard weeds. So things like bushy wallflower, blue mustard, tansy mustard. So those cool season weeds. And then we also spend a lot of time thinking about cool season grasses in our wheat. So the weedy brome species, so cheatgrass, true cheat, Japanese brome would be some. Jointed goatgrass is one that is kind of interesting. And we spent some time talking about this winter from the perspective of we have herbicide tolerant wheat varieties. And we have a weed in the field that is a very close relative. And so how do we manage jointed goatgrass? And how does that management strategy change in the context of herbicide resistant wheat varieties because of the threat of outcrossing? You know, the other crop that we see a lot of in those wheat-based systems would be grain sorghum. Again, we're starting to have herbicide-resistant grain sorghum varieties. And so same type of issue. We have shattercane and we have johnsongrass. And those are significant weed problems in their own right. We know we have some resistance in those species. They have always been hard to control. But now we have this potential, if we don't control these weeds well and manage our herbicide-tolerant grain sorghum well, we could create herbicide-resistant weeds as a result of outcrossing. So those are some things that kind of stay top of mind for me on a day-to-day basis. Another one I don't get a lot of calls about, but I think I would be remiss not to talk about field bindweed. That's basically why weed science started in the Great Plains, is because of field bindweed. I was talking with a farmer on Monday who likes to joke that when his ancestors moved here from Eastern Europe, they brought one bag of wheat seed and one bag of weed seed, and that's why there's so much field bindweed. So we have lots of job security as weed scientists, Leo.
That's right. I was going to say, you have a pretty long list of challenges to solve here. So that's, of course, from your perspective is great. And then I'm sure growers really benefit from all the knowledge that you and other colleagues create here to help them out.
So that's one of the interesting things about Kansas is how diverse our cropping systems are. And K-State has done a good job of positioning research stations. So, yeah, I have some great colleagues who help provide local data, local information to inform extension programs.
And so we talked about here the main wheat issues that you have in these different cropping systems. And then I guess to follow up with that, what are some of the strategies that growers are taking here to control? And especially, I think you brought something up that is so interesting as far as when you have a crop that have a resistant gene for a given herbicide, but you have a very close relative weed that can cross with that crop and perhaps obtain that resistance, that seems to be something that you're all thinking a lot as well. So, I guess coming back to the question of what are some strategies that growers are using here to control those weeds, especially in these cases where there's a potential for crossing those genes?
Yeah. So one of the things that is prevalent in thinking behind kind of current weed management is this idea of not tolerating weed seed production in our fields, right? So I'll show my age a little bit. Back when I was in school, there was work being done on systems to identify the economic threshold for a weed population that would trigger an economically beneficial herbicide application, right? So same kind of principles that the entomologists use a lot, right? If you have X number of bugs, that means you need to spray. Well, that what we're finding is that concept does not apply to weed management, right? Because weeds don't move. We know if we have weed seeds in the soil, we know we're going to have weed problems. And so that concept doesn't really apply. And we have really kind of shifted to this idea of zero tolerance for weed seed production, largely because of herbicide resistance. That is a huge threat for our crop production systems. So trying to get to that zero tolerance mark. And so, you know, that takes a D, all of the above type of approach, right? If you think about your multiple choice answers, it's not A, B, or C, it's D, it's A, B, and C, is the right answer to that question there. And so obviously herbicides, right, in our conventional broadacre ag systems, herbicides are going to be the most efficient, most economical way to do that, I'm going to say, for the rest of my career. So that is a key component of them, you know, making timely applications, using the right rates, and getting all of that right. Other things that we talk about would be cultural control practices. So my team has, and Rodrigo's team as well, has done some work looking at planting dates and row spacings, and how do we kind of manipulate that crop to make it as competitive as possible and maybe support our herbicides a little bit better so that we have fewer weeds to control. So that would be one aspect, would be kind of cultural control. Here in Kansas, we talk a lot about no-till, right? No-till is a very important soil conservation practice. It brings its own set of weed management challenges though, right? You're reliant on herbicides for weed control because, like it or not, the number one reason that tillage was a thing or is a thing is to kill weeds. And so when you remove that, you're 100% reliant on those herbicides. And so one of the things that is happening, and this is especially true in, I'm going to say, central to western Kansas, where the adoption of no-till has been particularly high because it helps conserve water in the soil, is we're starting to see kind of a return of perennial warm season grasses to those cropping systems. So we have a weed species called tumble windmill grass that is a perennial warm season native grass species. So anytime I talk to farmers and consultants about it, I remind them that tumble windmill grass was here a long time before that grain sorghum field or that wheat field. It belongs here. So we're trying to keep it out of its natural place. And so I bring that up because that's an example of a situation where something like strategic tillage or occasional tillage is becoming to be a more accepted, more common, more talked about idea for managing some of these key weeds in our systems. So, you know, we've got herbicides, we've got crop management practices, we've got tillage practices. We talk a lot about cover crops, crop rotation. But the one that, I don't know, I feel like it's, and again, a scientist shouldn't say feel, but I don't have data to support this, so I suppose that's an appropriate use of the term, Leo. I think that it is overlooked and undervalued is just the idea of prevention and sanitation. Here in Kansas, a lot of farmers also have cattle. And so thinking about where and how and what we're feeding our cattle, what we're doing with the byproducts of that livestock production, right? You have experience in soil fertility. You know that livestock manure is very valuable, but if it's not been composted well, if that animal has had a diet that's full of weed seeds, right, that's going to introduce a whole nother set of problems. So that's one example. I know Rodrigo's got a really good extension agent in Wisconsin that has spent a lot of time thinking about combine cleaning equipment. I talk to some of the undergrads here in one of their classes, and I remind them that if they're a field scout in the summer, they need to be careful to not make their four-wheeler or their work boots a weed seed dispersal instrument, right? Because it only takes, you know, one instance of having that introduction to have a serious problem with something for a long time if you don't get a hold of it and get control of it early.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. I mean, there's definitely a lot of tools here that could be used, but I really enjoyed your explanation around as you come from perhaps a conventional tillage system into a no-till system. Well, first, some of the tools in the toolbox are not available anymore just because of the system, but also what are some of the other challenges that come along with that? I think that was really, really interesting point here. So perhaps to follow up with that, I think you may have touched on this a little bit with the previous question, but is there something that goes beyond what you said when it comes to controlling weeds in these water limited environments that we have in large portions of Kansas?
That is one of the biggest challenges. So I will say that our farmers in Western Kansas recognize that every day that weed is growing, it's taking water that we would rather be giving to a crop. And so weed management, especially in that kind of after wheat, in that wheat stubble phase of the operation, is really important to those folks. And that is one of the places where some of this new technology as far as targeted herbicide applications, I think, is really beneficial for Kansas farmers in particular. So I think probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with the See and Spray system. That's probably the one that has had the most press. But there's other systems available that, for example, there's a system called WeedIts that quite a few of the farmers that I have interacted with in Western Kansas use simply to reduce their weed management costs during that wheat stubble or that fallow phase of their operation. In fact, I did some interviews, I guess it was two summers ago now, of folks. And one of the farmers that I interviewed actually credited the targeted herbicide application system with allowing them to switch to a no-till production system. So now they feel like they know they've looked at the economic numbers, right? So now they know that they can kill the weeds with herbicide applications, drop that herbicide cost below the cost of running a sweep plow, running tillage equipment across that field. And so it's allowed them to gain those benefits of conserving moisture. The other thing that we spend a lot of time talking about, and this doesn't apply to Kansas, this isn't necessarily a water limited thing, but when it gets hot and it gets dry, our farmers in Kansas are really good at modifying their herbicide applications to make sure that they're still going to be efficacious in those very difficult conditions. So, you know, I talk to a lot of colleagues who really struggle with farmers and applicators using enough spray volume. I occasionally hear folks of really kind of cheating on the spray volume to try to be more efficient with their applications. But by and large, the farmers that I interact with in Western Kansas, they know that if they skimp on the water, they're wasting their time. And so they do a good job of accounting for that and modifying their adjuvants and knowing when to switch. So yeah, moving to Kansas has been, you know, such an education for me just in seeing the diversity. And it's exciting to get to talk to folks who are in cropping systems that are very, very similar to Missouri and Illinois, all the way to folks who are farming with 14 inches of rain a year, right? It's a very diverse system.
Awesome. Yeah, that definitely different challenges that they have that then you can help them through research. So challenges on the ground that become a diversity from the perspective of the research as well that you have to conduct to help them out. Yeah. Nice. Fantastic. Well, we're getting towards the latter part of our episode. And before I ask you the three questions that we ask every guest, I do want to speak with our audience. So if you're listening to this episode or you're enjoying it, make sure to subscribe to our podcast in whichever platform you're listening. Drop us a like. Make sure to share this episode with other people. I'm learning a lot from Dr. Sarah Lancaster, and I'm sure other people that you know may also benefit from this great conversation.
It's time for our famous three.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
All right, Sarah. So we're getting towards the three questions here. The first one that I have for you is, do you have any resource that you came across that you found that is very useful for you and that you could share with us, and especially something related to agriculture? So something on your area of expertise.
So I'll give you two. The first one I would suggest is that most states, Kansas does, North Dakota does, I think Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio have one big book, but there is an extension weed control guide in all likelihood for your state, or one that's produced with cooperation with neighboring states. Those can be great resources. They've got data on, you know, local efficacy for ratings for different weed control programs. And one of the things that the Kansas guide does is we have kind of a synopsis of the high points of the label, right? So you can kind of rule out herbicides based on some of those label requirements. So that would be one that I think is a really good resource. The other one that I'll mention, at the risk of shameless self-promotion and sounding somewhat like a used car salesman, there is a podcast called The War Against Weeds. And it's a podcast that I put together with a couple of really great colleagues, Joe Eichle from North Dakota State and Alyssa Essman from Ohio State University. We talk to different weed scientists. Sometimes we talk to farmers and consultants and try to kind of hit some timely issues for weed control as we go through the spring and the fall. But also we just try to talk about kind of current and upcoming research and other interesting things. For example, this year we talked to somebody about using dogs to find invasive weeds, right? So everything from drone weed control to herbicide resistance updates to kind of, yeah, those kind of fun things like with weed sniffing dogs. So War Against Weeds, and, you know, much like your podcast, we have it on most of the major platforms, so they can check that out if they're interested specifically in things related to weed management.
Nice. Well, I have a couple of comments about that. The first one is, I think you're the first guest that actually gives two resources on the same question. So that's a plus. Thank you for
that.
Yeah. I mean, I have not listened to your podcast yet, but so just to say it again, War Against Weeds podcast, right?
Yep. That's it.
Perfect. So if our audience has weed science interest, please check that out. And I personally have a dog that loves to smell, to sniff weeds. It's just not being trained to identify them. Maybe I'll listen to that episode and tell you what happens. All right. So our next question here is pretty similar as far as a resource that you have found useful for you that you could share with us, however, outside of agriculture.
So one of the, so as an extension specialist, I spend a lot of time in my vehicle. And if I'm not on the phone, hands-free, of course, right? If I'm not on the phone, I listen to a lot of audiobooks. And an author that I just really appreciated listening to lately is Brené Brown. So she's a PhD in sociology, psychology, I don't know, one of those touchy-feely areas of expertise. But man, she is real about relationships in the workplace and just understanding kind of how people are wired and what makes us tick. And it is so helpful just to think about that. One of the things that I really took away early on when I started listening to her was this idea of assuming good intentions, right? We always assume the best intentions of ourselves, but we also have to assume good intentions of those around us. So just
to recap here, Brené Brown, and is there like one specific book or audiobook, or is it anything from her you would recommend?
I have enjoyed all of her stuff and found it to be insightful. So, yeah.
Nice. So check out Brené Brown, and that would be a great resource. I think I have read, not a book, but I read something about Brené Brown and I think she gave a TED Talk that I was reading the synopsis of it. And definitely a really great speaker and really great content there for sure. But thanks for sharing that. All right. So our last of the three questions is, what types of skills or skill set have you observed in successful people around you?
So the things that come to mind, right, we kind of assume some technical knowledge, right? We probably got the piece of paper that says we can do that. I think that just attitude, willingness to give and take feedback, willingness to want to learn and just put forth the effort. I honestly think that that is the number one thing to look for, as far as separating the good from the great. The other thing that is a little more maybe tangible and that I have been reflecting on, not to divulge too much, but time management, man, there are so many things we can do. And it's easy to let good become the enemy of great, right? And you don't want to say yes to so many things that you're not doing any of them well. And I will openly admit that I flirt with that line.
Nice. That's great. Great points there as well. I appreciate you sharing that. I think that a lot of times, people with PhDs and perhaps people that look at people with PhDs will think that, oh, they have a PhD. They know it all. They don't have to learn anymore, which is so wrong, right? I mean, if anything, we just learn how to learn more and how little we know by the end of your PhD.
I think that's the point of the dissertation defense, right? To remind you that even though you learned all this stuff, it's a drop in the bucket.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's definitely, yeah, I appreciate you sharing that. All right. Well, this brings us to the end of the episode. So Sarah, really appreciated having you as a guest today. As always, I learned a lot from our guests, and I learned a lot with you today about weed management, weed issues, especially in Kansas. So I appreciate all the conversation. It was great having you here.
Thanks for being a good host, Leo.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.